Hello, podcast listeners. We know podcasts are a great way to catch up on a program that you may have missed on KSJE, and it's provided as a free service of this radio station. But you know, KSJE is now listener-supported, and so while you enjoy this podcast, we hope that you'll also take some time to join KSJE. Become a member today. It's quite easy to do. Just go to our website at ksje.com/support and pick the level of support that best matches your budget. Thanks again for listening. Here's your podcast.
Welcome back to Right on Four Corners. I'm Delcherie Gladden. I'm a USA Today bestselling author with over 30 published novels. And on this week's show, I have Marty Eberhardt, and she's going to be talking about her newest book, Bones in the Back 40. Marty, go ahead and introduce yourself.
Okay. Well, I'm new to writing fiction, unlike my interviewer, my gosh, 30 books. I'm on book two. I was a nonprofit director of, actually a botanical garden director of a couple botanical gardens as part of my professional career. And when I retired, I decided I should start using the right side of my brain and thought, wow, wouldn't it be fun to write botanical garden murder mysteries? So I did that, and my first book, Death in a Desert Garden, was published in 2021. And I did win the Arizona New Mexico Book Award and a few other awards, Arizona New Mexico Book Award for Cozy Mystery, and a few other awards. And I went on to book two, Bones in the Back 40, which takes place in a botanical garden in Tucson, as does mystery number one, but also in New Mexico, in a small town called Copperton. And I'll leave it at that for the moment.
All right. So working on the second book, how was that compared to going through the process with writing and publishing the first book?
Well, I don't know. It honestly wasn't that different. Some people have told me that they, you know, wrote much faster. The biggest change probably was because I had a very good, you know, idea of what my editor liked and didn't like in book number one and wanted me to change. I was able to think about that as I went through. But other than that, and changing the location and giving a real, trying to give a real sense of the landscape of the Gila region, it was pretty similar to time number one.
Good. A lot of times I talk to authors and that second book, it's almost like stage fright sometimes, and it can be a lot more challenging. So I think that's great that you were able to just dive back into it and get the book going and enjoy that process.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Maybe they have stage fright because they were like a New York Times bestseller or something like that, and they're afraid they can't live up to it. I didn't have that problem.
Well, that's a good thing, I would say. To not feel like you have to live up to anything. I think writing is such a personal experience, even though, yes, we are writing for readers and we keep that in mind and we keep our editors and publishers and all of that. It's still so much of a personal thing that making sure you love it and enjoy it and want to read it, I think, really helps translate into everyone else loving and enjoying it, wanting to read it.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Now, did you start the first book with the plan that it would be a series?
I did. Yeah, I definitely did. It's a cozy mystery, and cozy mysteries in general tend to be series. And and I figured I would do a minimum of three.
That's a good starting place, especially, I think, for the first series. I think it's funny. One of my favorite authors, Jim Butcher, told a story that when he was working on his Dresden Files series in college, and he's talking to his creative writing professor, and he's like, oh, here's my plan, and there's 21 books. And she's like, whoa, you're not going to sell a 21 book series your first time out. And she's like, you got to break that down, you know, pitch the first three books first and go from there.
Yeah.
And yeah, he, you know, it, it was a really long series. It hasn't ended yet. But yeah, she was just like, that's a bit much. Let's scale that back here, Jim.
Well, even incredibly accomplished writers, to do 21 books, that's got to take a pretty dedicated fan base, I have to say.
Yeah. And at this point, he has it. And, you know, it's working really well. But yeah, with that being your goal first time out, that was quite mm-hmm. the goal. I mean, he made it work, but I don't know that everybody could.
No.
So tell me about your main character, Bea Rivers. She was a lot of fun to read. I really enjoyed her character overall. And I'm getting to her in the second book where she's had a little bit of development through that first book. And
right. We
get references to that in this one in Bones in the Back 40. But yeah, tell me about how you developed her and just where she came from, because she was a lot of fun to get to know.
Well, yeah, in the first book, she really doesn't have a whole lot of self-confidence. She's a 38-year-old single parent. She's recently been divorced, and it wasn't too amicable. And, you know, she's dealing with that and dealing with trying to work full-time, and she's in a new job, and she's not making very much money, and there are a lot of stresses, and she isn't really sure, too sure of herself. But in book one, she ends up being very helpful to the police detective, who turns out to have been an old friend of hers. And so in book two, which is Bones in the Back 40, she really starts to come into her own, and she has to step up. Because, and I won't say why, but she suddenly has to step into the director role at the Gardens, and she was education director / volunteer manager. So that's a big change. And she rises to the occasion, and she also kind of asserts herself with her boyfriend too, because it's a little tough because he's not really totally dedicated to staying in Tucson. So yeah, I'm trying to show, you know, the evolution of a young woman who is presented with a lot of challenges, and they make her, they don't break her.
And that is something with Bea's character that I really liked, was seeing her strength, even from the beginning of book two to the end. And things feel a little frazzled at the beginning for her in her personal life, which I can relate to.
Mm-hmm.
And
sure.
She really just, as each issue comes up that she's asked to deal with, you see her really kind of have to dig deeper and find ways to manage everything that's going on. And it's a lot for one person to try to manage everything that she has going on in her life just on a day-to-day basis. And then a murder investigation is thrown into the middle of everything else, which only makes it even tougher. But yeah, I really enjoyed watching her grow and change over just even the course of this second book. And she's one that I would enjoy following and seeing where else she goes and how she develops in your next book as well.
Well, that's wonderful to hear. I would like to say that I do think the issue of single parenting is not, you don't see a lot of it in fiction, and certainly not in mysteries. And I think that single parents are an underwritten group of people, because there are a lot of them out there, and people who have read the first book have said to me, oh boy, I could sure relate to that because I was a single parent. So many people have said that to me. And, you know, I think one reason we don't read a lot about single parenting is because single parents don't have time to write. they have to be like my age before they're like, oh, okay, I think I have time to write about that. So, so anyway, I feel like that. And parenting and working in general, everybody who does both of those things can relate to how tough that is. But single parenting and working and murder investigation and, you know, is really a lot.
It is a lot, yeah. And I definitely agree that that is not something that you see often enough in fiction. And when you said that, it made me think, I started out writing young adult fiction, and you'll hear people mention something called like the problem of parents. And when you're writing YA, it's like, oh, how do we get rid of the parents so the kids have to deal, you know, with these situations? And, you know, you kind of have to get creative sometimes to not have the parents swoop in and save everything. And I think you have the opposite issue writing a single parent of what do we do with these kids? If they've got to run off and, you know, follow something or investigate something, or it's like every real life single parent, which I, you know, my kids are older now, but I definitely still understand that of, you know, if you need to go do something and you have small children like Bea does, you've got to find someone to watch them. Like, you can't just run off at any point. Yeah. Like, if you're just by yourself, you can, I got an idea. I'm going to go check it out. It's like, wait, hold on. Got to feed the kids. Got to get them to bed. Got to get them to school the next morning.
And I wanted to show that. I heard a couple people discussing and saying, well, you can't have kids in mysteries because it interrupts the pace. You've got to, you know, do all this stuff, and kids kind of get in the way. And I'm like, yeah, that's the point. They do. They do. And that's life. And, you know, I want to write something realistic here.
Yeah. And I think not only does it bring up a new group of readers that can really relate to that character, it's also like empowering in a way, even though, you know, these are fictional characters, that's like, okay, yeah, I have a lot on my plate, but I can handle it. Like, I can get through this. I can do this. Okay. Look at Bea. She solved murder. You know, I think there's a fun element to that.
Loving parent.
Yeah. She made it work. She, you know, she has to lean on friends and family, and it's not, you know, all about her. But I felt like that really brought a roundness to her character that it would have been challenging to show all of those sides of her without having the kids as part of the story.
Good.
So, yeah, I really enjoyed it. I also enjoyed the historical and the cultural aspects that you brought in. I've lived pretty much all of my life in the Southwest, New Mexico, Colorado, Arizona areas. So a lot of the idea of, you know, the pot hunting, the excavation of the ruins, what was protected, what wasn't, you know, in some of the time period where you're going back to in this, back into like the 70s. Some of that are things that I was familiar with having grown up in this area. But I would guess that a lot of people reading this who aren't from the Southwest may not know a lot of the intricacies of how this has developed over time when it comes to ancestral ruins and artifacts and working with Native American tribes to reclaim some of those. And you delve into a lot of that. I wanted to ask you about your process of researching those aspects and then how you went about dealing with it in a culturally sensitive way.
Okay. Well, first of all, I'm an archaeological site steward for the Gila National Forest. So what we do is we're assigned a couple of Mimbres sites, and we report on them at least quarterly, which means checking and seeing if anybody's been looting. So this is kind of close to my heart in this area, in the area of Mimbres culture. But, you know, the laws are complicated and have changed very much through time. And I wanted to make sure I got that right. So I did talk to a Forest Service representative whose specialty is those laws. And she clarified everything for me. And then I had an archaeologist friend read it and make sure I didn't make any serious errors. Although if there are errors, they're mine. So, you know, I did those things. In terms of being culturally sensitive, I wanted to make sure that everybody understood that there are, even though the Mimbres are, you know, long gone, there are current tribes who believe that they are their ancestors and they need to be brought into any kind of restoration. So I did have that happen, restoration of stolen goods, that is. So I guess the other thing I'd like to say about that is it's an issue that I want people to understand that it's just really not okay to pick up stuff and take it home, even if you see it. And there are still people who do that, who figure that that's okay, but not okay to bulldoze. They get that. But it's not okay even to pick stuff that you find on the ground and bring it home. So I wanted to kind of make that clear to folks in a gentle and entertaining way.
And I think you did a really good job of that. And I appreciate it as well that you did try to show both sides, especially in the historical aspect, when you were talking about the earlier decades and the people who were involved in some of the potsherd hunting and just what a different culture it was at that time. And not that that made it good or okay, but you tried, I thought, to be very sensitive to the fact that there wasn't the same level of understanding and sense of stewardship at that time period, and the laws were quite different. You gave an interesting perspective of both sides of the situation, and I really felt like that brought forward, okay, and this is where we are today, and this is our understanding, and this is where we hold the level of responsibility.
Right.
And we need to do better. That makes sense.
And if we didn't get it in 1969, when a lot of this happened, there's no excuse for not getting it now. People can change. And, you know, the people who didn't change about that, there are some of those in the book. That's all we'll say about that.
Yes. And, you know, unfortunately, there are always people out there who feel that their needs and ambitions and what have you are more important than anything else. And that's an unfortunate thing that, you know, other people who are trying to be respectful have to battle against. And I'm sure working as a site steward, you said you guys go through and check on that. Is that something that you do come up against very often still?
I haven't at all. I haven't at all. And we haven't as a chapter in the Gila. Since I've been doing this, and I've been doing it for about 10 years, but we haven't. In northern New Mexico, there have been problems. And there were problems a little more than 10 years ago. So it's not in our area. So we're not out of the woods. But it has been really encouraging. Well, that's not entirely true. They're one of the most popular sites in the Silver City area, the dragonfly site. Somebody etched Joe and Liz on a rock by the petroglyph. So that kind of stuff happens. Actually going in and like bulldozing and digging up stuff in private sites, I mean in public lands, which used to happen pretty frequently, we haven't been happening.
Oh, that's good. That is encouraging that the wider population is understanding a little bit better the respectful nature that should be common at this point.
Mm-hmm. And there's a really nice public education program for kids that Archaeological Society supports. And that, you know, that's really helpful too. The kids get it so they can tell their parents, oh, we're not supposed to pick up all those potsherds we find, Mom and Dad. So I'm actually quite impressed with the kids' education programs.
That's awesome. That is often what it takes is, you know, starting at that younger age to start opening up perspectives and teaching that generation to lead the older generations.
Mm-hmm. That's what happened with recycling.
True. Yeah. I think that's really been a big factor in a few big movements toward improvement of cultural and societal areas over the last couple of decades. And hopefully it keeps continuing.
Yeah.
So tell me about your experience, because like you said, this is set in a botanical garden, and that's something that you have personal experience with. So tell me a little bit about that and how you were able to bring your passion for the natural world into this series.
Well, it's a botanical garden in the Sonoran Desert, and I love the Sonoran Desert. I think it's a glorious and beautiful, spectacular environment. So I wanted to set the series there. There are, as you well know, a lot of books set in the Four Corners area. But there's not that much set in the Sonoran Desert. And I wanted to give people people a really good sense in this series, particularly of the seasons. So the first one is in the monsoon season. Well, the monsoons haven't quite happened. They don't happen until the end of the book. So they're building and they're building and people are going crazy because it's so hot, but it's not raining yet. And so their frustration level mounts as the mystery's not quite yet solved. And then the mystery gets solved and it rains. So there's a release factor. And the second one is takes place in winter, which is, of course, the tourist season. It takes place in January, February, right now. And it's high season for tourists because the weather's really quite nice, usually. And, you know, everything changes because there's so many people around. And then little wildflowers are starting to come. And then, you know, it moves into the glories of spring. And, you know, I'll have one set in the glories of spring. You know? So, you know, I just wanted to communicate all of that feeling for the Sonoran Desert and for its extraordinary plants. I mean, just saguaros are just so much fun. So, yeah, that was, there were several things I was trying to communicate. One of them was the difficulty of single parenthood, and another one was just what a wonderful place the Sonoran Desert is.
I think that's really neat. This is such a unique part of the country that even, you know, being here in Farmington, we're a high desert, and I have friends and writer people that, you know, I talk with online and whatever. And the past little bit, we've been getting snow and it's been freezing. And like, it's funny how many people, like, I'll mention weather too here. And they're like, what? I thought you lived in the desert.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, the high desert. Like, it still gets real cold here. And it's just, it's
like a difference of several thousand feet.
And it can change so drastically just, you know, in this area. And I think that that is a neat aspect of writing in the Southwest, is the unique landscape, the weather, the cultures. And it's really fun to share that. And I'm not super familiar with the Sonoran Desert, but I did really enjoy learning more about it and seeing some of those differences from, you know, high desert to where they're at. And I thought it was interesting you mentioned, you know, classes for the snowbirds on how to garden and landscape in basically like a completely foreign world to most people who move there.
Completely, yes.
That's a lot of fun, I think, to be able to share something that you experience every day and is your normal. And for other people, it's just a little bit mind-boggling when they first get to the Southwest in a lot of cases. I've had multiple friends tell me that, where they're just like, this place is so weird.
Yeah,
in a good way, but
I actually had a couple people who read the first book who live in the South, in the Southeast, say, you know, I didn't get this desert thing that you had going on, Marty, but now I kind of get it. So I thought, oh, good. If people who don't know the desert at all can understand part of why some of us love it, that's good.
Yeah.
And maybe they can help preserve it, too.
Yes. Yeah, and I wanted to ask you before we run out of time, just on more the mystery side of it and how you developed that without, you know, giving anything away. But yeah, what was your approach to developing the mystery for this book?
Well, I always figure out whodunit. That's kind of the first step that I have to work with. And then I try to develop an interesting cast of characters, some of whom are suspects. I mean, I absolutely love writing characters. That's probably, besides the landscape descriptions, that's my favorite part of writing. And I try to make my plots, you know, complicated enough that nobody's going to get it early on, and, you know, throw in several wrong turns and red herrings, and, you know, just try to make it, and I try to make the pacing such that, you know, you're not getting bored, that something happens on a fairly regular basis. But, you know, it is a cozy mystery. I'm not, there is no gore. It's not particularly graphic. And most of the stress is psychological. And, the... I think I better not say too much more about that because I might give too much away.
Understandable.
I think I'll just stop there.
So tell me about the third book and where you're at with it and what you're planning for that one.
Well, I'm just starting it, but I actually, as I told you, I lived in San Diego for quite a while. So I wanted to have continuity, so it will start off in the Sonoran Desert in the spring to give people that. But most of it is going to occur in a coastal community in Southern California, where B will be at a botanical garden director's meeting. And I haven't got it all figured out yet, but I'm hoping to give people a sense of that environment as well. And I guess that's about all I have to say about it, because I'm not very far along.
Well, that's okay. That gives us something to look forward to. And I think that'll be neat to see B in a different environment and seeing her progress on a personal level, too. And just, getting a chance to watch her character grow and see what she does in this next one. So I'm excited for it.
Well, good. I'm glad to hear that.
Now, the book, again, is Bones in the Back 40, and it's the second book in the Bee Rivers Mystery Series. And where can people find you, and where can they find the book?
Well, my website is Marty Eberhardt, MartyEberhardt. HARDT.com, MartyEberhardt.com. And you can find the book, at all your usual online sales places, and hopefully at your local bookstore. And if you can't, you should ask them to order it for you. But it's produced by a traditional press, Artemisia Publishing, out of Albuquerque, and it is with major distributors, so it shouldn't be hard for bookstores to get it.
Awesome. And libraries as well. Sometimes people don't realize
Right.
They can request that their libraries will order copies as well, and that can be a great way to get it out there and share it with your community too.
Yeah, that's true. In fact, one of my relatives who lives in Sacramento asked the Sacramento Public Library to get 7 copies.
Nice.
Yes.
Well, good. Well, yeah, so this is a really fun, cozy mystery. I really enjoyed it, and I hope readers go check it out and grab a copy and start getting to know Bee Rivers and her life in the Sonoran Desert.
Well, thanks. I really appreciated the opportunity to talk with you about it. There's 30 books.
And one of these days, I might actually get another one published. It's been slow going lately, but that's okay. But thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me today. I really enjoyed the book and really enjoyed chatting with you as well.
Yeah, me too.
Did you enjoy that podcast? We hope that you did. And if you did, share it with your friends. And if you really want to keep podcasts like this coming, please support KSJE. You can do it easily online at ksje.com.